Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Our money is trying to tell us something. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 21st day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our money and the stories it tells us coming up in just a bit. But first, couple of quick things macro-wise up at the top here, and then we will get to our leads of the day. First of all, just to get you all ahead of this a little bit, you're going to be hearing a lot about the debt limit the next week or so, the statutory ceiling on how much money the federal government is allowed to borrow. As we mentioned more than a couple of times, I think the current waiver of that limit runs out at the end of this month. And so you are starting to hear Republicans say they are not going to have anything to do with raising that ceiling, which makes it news that the Congressional Budget Office said today, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, to be clear. The CBO said the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is going to be able to scrape together enough money to keep paying the bills till October or November. Remember, the lesson here is that the politics of this economy aren't always the whole story. Also, just real quick, stocks, honestly, whatever, just wanted to point out, as I do from time to time, the bond market yield on the benchmark U.S. 10-year bond firmly stuck near 1.3% the past week or so. So not all that worried about inflation, but maybe worried about growth and the Delta variant. That is still to come. Speaking of the pandemic, as we have been for, a year and a half now, it is changing a bunch of things in this economy, some of them a lot, others not. In that latter category of things not changing as much as we thought, where people are choosing to live and work post-pandemic. We have seen, as we've told you, people leaving big, expensive cities on the coast, some. But there is new analysis out from Zillow that shows homebuyers are increasingly just looking for places on the periphery of some of those cities. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino gets us going.
For years before the pandemic, housing prices were growing fastest in areas closest to jobs, typically in dense urban centers. But the pandemic has flipped the trend, says Nancy Wu, an economist with Zillow.
The proximity to being close to downtown is being traded for longer commute times for greater affordability farther away.
Because many workers aren't going into the office as much and are looking for more space. Housing prices an hour or more from job centers grew the fastest in expensive metros over the last 2 years. Prices closer in, while still not exactly low, grew at the slowest rate and in some cases actually dropped.
We are seeing that a 10-minute commute in New York is now $73,000, almost $74,000 cheaper than it was in 2019.
Home buying is a long-term decision, she says, and that means hybrid and remote work are likely here to stay. And that could reshape cities, says Richard Florida, an urban planning professor.
Remote work is just the latest technology that stretches the boundaries of metropolitan areas.
Just like trains and cars did before. He says the rearrangement could make urban centers slightly more accessible to younger people or lower-income workers who have largely been priced out. But it's a troubling development for the environment, says Adi Tomer, a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Using more space uses more resources. It's a fairly simple math calculation.
While hybrid workers further out may visit the office less frequently, he says they'll be more car reliant, travel longer distances, and live in bigger houses that use more energy. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
All right, here is a paperwork story with potentially big financial implications. Two reports out this week showing fewer students have been applying for college financial aid since the pandemic started. Just 68% of families with students in college filled out the free application for federal student aid, FAFSA is what that gets called for short, last year. That is the lowest that number's been in the 14 years Sallie Mae has been tracking it. It's their report. Also, the number of graduating high school seniors who filled out the FAFSA, that's also down, off 8.5% in the past 2 years. And that is according to the National College Attainment Network. And the drops matter because the FAFSA is the only way to qualify for most need-based aid. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains what's going on there.
In a year when millions of people lost their jobs and have been struggling financially, Ashley Boucher at Sallie Mae says she would have hoped to see more people filling out the FAFSA.
The last thing I want to see when finances could potentially be tight for families is them not taking advantage of the resources that are out there.
Instead, the number of students applying for financial aid has dropped significantly.
That's particularly true for the people who tend to have the hardest time paying for college, who go disproportionately to community colleges.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb runs the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple University. And she says one big reason for that is a lot of students just spent a year in virtual classes,
which in many cases led to disengagement and led them to question whether, in fact, they want to go on to more learning.
Studying remotely also meant many low-income students weren't as connected to counselors and college access programs, says Allie Levy at the organization College Access Research and Action.
Students really rely on school support to get through the application process and financial aid process. And without that ready access to counselors, it was harder to get through the process.
The National College Attainment Network estimates about 270,000 fewer high school seniors have filled out the FAFSA since the pandemic began. Moralee Keller at NCAN says the biggest drops have been among low-income students and students of color.
It's a huge deal. Students who complete a FAFSA have a much higher post-secondary enrollment rate than those students who do not.
Keller says if more students go back to in-person school in the fall,
you hope for a little bit of some rebound starting with the class of 22.
But she says it's going to take a lot of work to get students who did not enroll these last 2 years back to college. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, bonds. Y'all, I said that just a couple of minutes ago. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Yesterday made it 6 months of the Biden administration, two of the big themes of which have been racial equity, the subject of one of the very first executive orders the president signed, and environmental infrastructure, a big part of the bill that is oh so slowly working its way through Congress. Yesterday, though, those two themes came together in the form of 13 pages of instructions from the White House to federal agencies to make sure that disadvantaged communities get a big chunk of the benefits from all the government spending on energy and the environment that is planned. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
If you want to understand the kinds of problems that this memo is trying to tackle, Robert Bullard, an environmental justice historian at Texas Southern University, says you got to refer back to the Jim Crow South.
You know, I grew up in the South, in the Deep South in the 60s, and we saw the separate and unequal and the roads being paved in the white community and stopped paved in the black community.
Today, underprivileged communities have to deal with poor environmental quality, and Jonathan London, an associate professor of human ecology at the University of California, Davis, says that's not all.
One of the key things in environmental justice is the idea of cumulative impacts.
That means people who are out of work or earn low wages are more likely to be dealing with substandard housing, air pollution, or lousy water quality.
The most disadvantaged communities are those that are facing the highest concentration of multiple kinds of threats. And so it really requires this holistic approach.
So this memo tasks 21 federal agencies and departments with helping communities that are, quote, overburdened and underserved. But it's only initial guidance. David Pello, a professor of environmental studies at UC Santa Barbara, says this memo reflects the priorities of the Biden administration, but that's also kind of the problem.
Executive orders reflect the moment, who's in power, who's got the majority. It's always subject to being overturned and challenged.
The good thing about this memo, says Texas Southern's Robert Bullard, is that it gets to the core of what environmental justice means.
Infrastructure can improve health and quality of life. That's how money should be spent.
The White House says it'll be providing an interactive mapping tool that agencies can use to identify the areas of greatest need. Now that's something environmental justice advocates have wanted for years. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I've been in New York the past couple of days, as I mentioned as we got going, and I'm happy to be able to confirm that that whole New York is dead because so many people are leaving thing is nonsense. People are out and about. Manhattan is as busy and as noisy and as chaotic as it ever was. But one of New York's most iconic industries still needs a little time. Broadway is not back in force until September. So yesterday, I wandered over toward the Theater District for a chat with Ava Price. She's our Broadway producer friend with the Tony Award-winning revival of Oklahoma on her list of credits. Also, Jagged Little Pill. How are you? It's so good to see you.
Good to see you.
Thank
oh
you for
God.
Taking the time. I know. It's been a couple of years.
Eyes.
I know. Right over there. We were at Sardi's.
We were poor, closed Sardi's.
Poor, closed Sardi's. Sardi's is something of a Broadway institution, also where Eva and I first met, and across the street from where we were standing yesterday. Tell people where we are.
We are on 44th Street, just a block from Times Square in front of the Broadhurst Theater, home to Jagged Little Pill.
The funny part is we're standing outside because nobody's allowed in.
Correct.
Still.
Correct.
How are you guys going to open in, what, 2 months if nobody can get in?
It's a little more than 2 months.
Well, and where are we going? August, February. Not much more than 2 months.
October
maybe
21st.
Maybe three. Okay, maybe
October
3 months. 21st.
People can get in.
Yes.
We're just not in yet.
All
right. We're going to be starting rehearsals in September, and we're going to start checking out the equipment and the costumes and the set and, you know, sure it works.
Are you exhausted?
I'm an athlete out of shape, so that's why I'm exhausted.
That's a really good analogy. That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, I mean, working 10, 12 hours a day, morning, noon, and night was like part of the day's work.
Yeah.
And to go cold and only Zoom to all of a sudden be running around, it's taking a toll.
So what are you doing during the day? Are you like rounding up people and make sure contracts are done and all that stuff?
Totally. All of that, you know, getting ready for opening, getting ready for the Tony Awards, getting ready.
For which this has like a dozen and change nominations,
15,
right?
Kai. Let's be exact when we can. You are a journalist after all.
That's facts matter. Facts matter. Fair enough. Ouch. What's it going to be like, do you think? Are you calling it opening night? What are you calling it? Reopening night? There's got to be some Broadway branded thing,
right? I don't know. I mean, we're calling it reopening night,
yeah.
I guess.
How much time are you spending on protocols and health and all of that stuff? And I ask because over there at the St. James, Bruce Springsteen, he's back fully vaccinated, right? That's the deal. You got to be fully vaccinated to go to that show.
That is the deal. We are spending a lot of time on all of that. We are working with epidemiologists and the unions and the CDC and the state to make sure that we follow every protocol and that we adapt. Because, like you said, it's July. The show opens in October.
Yeah.
What can change? You know, much is the answer based on what we've learned.
We talked maybe two times ago, about all the people who depended on this industry for a living, who had to do something else for a year and a half, right? Stagehands and catering people and all of that. And some portion of them have left to go do something else. And we talked about how, you know, you hope they'll come back, blah, blah, blah. Here's my question, though, and it's a little personal, but whatever.
Yeah.
How come you stuck with it?
I don't know if I know how to do anything else now. I think it would have taken something other than a pandemic to push me out. And it's because it's hard to do. It's really, really hard to be a Broadway producer and to work in the live theater industry. And if I thought there was something else that I'd enjoy doing, I think I would have left pre-pandemic, never mind from it. My heart is here.
We should say here, this is not the only thing you've got going on, right? There are tours and, I mean, you've got things in Australia and other shows.
It's true.
Right? You're trying to stand up a whole you know, enterprise here.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough because it's different everywhere you go right now.
Yeah.
Australia is currently in lockdown.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, similarly with this country, I've got three tours launching this fall. And every state is suffering or progressing in different ways right now. That's actually scarier than Broadway.
I don't want to end on a downer, so I'll make this the second to last question. What happens if the reopening doesn't work? If the crowds don't come back?
They're going to come back, Kai. They're going to come back. They might come back thinner. They might take longer to come back. But we're in it for the long game. I wasn't in it to see what I could pull off by 45. I got into it to see what I could pull off for the next 30 years. And it's a great question. It's a real question. What if they don't come back? But I don't think there's going to be a time where Broadway isn't booming again. I don't think there's going to be a time where humanity isn't going to want to sit in a theater together again. It's just, when is that time? Is it September? Is it later? Only time will tell.
All right. So that's the ender. That actually was the last question. Eva Price, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up.
Money is a really powerful way to send a message.
I mean, yeah. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 286 today, 0.8%, closed at 34,798. The NASDAQ gained 113 points, about 0.9%, 14,631. S&P 500 up 35 points, 0.8%, 43.58. Slew of positive earnings today. Chipotle lifted 11.5%. A lot of burrito bowls, I guess. Coca-Cola bubbled up 1.2%. Verizon found about 0.6%. You heard from Mueller about energy and environmental spending, thus checking in on some energy stocks. NextEra Energy Partners down 1.6% today. ConocoPhillips up 4.6%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Oh, look, there it is. 1.29%. Right around 1.3. Like I said, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to do a little behind the scenes in this next story, a little breaking of the fourth wall around a piece that our China correspondent Jennifer Pack did back in April about one of the few remaining and affordable transportation options for poor Chinese who live way out in the countryside. Slow trains, they're called. Turns out that story was picked up by one of China's government-run newspapers, translated into Chinese, and published. So, of course, Jennifer went looking for a copy.
This morning, my friend sent me a picture. She saw a Chinese translation of our article in a newspaper called the Global Times. But finding a newspaper in Shanghai these days is not an easy task. Our news assistant, Charles Zhang, though, says he has managed to find a newspaper stand, and I'm on my way to meet him now.
I tell the taxi driver my mission. He says he hasn't bought a newspaper in years. He prefers to get information from social media, like TikTok's China version, called Douyin.
They push whatever content you're interested in. Each video user has his or her own style, and you can comment.
It's entertaining, he says. Unlike the government-run media, the Global Times translated our story into Chinese about how the government trains help the poor. But it cut out mentions of inflation or the high cost of living.
I don't read domestic Chinese news because all government-run news in China is fake.
The taxi driver didn't give his name out of fear.
Because you're foreign media, it's hard to say what would happen.
I get out of the cab and meet up with our assistant, Charles, and ask him,
how many places did you go to before you found a newspaper?
I talked to 7 places and went to 6 kiosks.
So I asked the man at the newsstand Charles found, how's business?
You want to do an interview? You need approval from my leader.
This is not what he told Charles before I arrived with the microphone. But we follow the protocol and apply for permission from his leader, or parent company, China Post. The newsstand man, though, told Charles that the story of disappearing newsstands is a sensitive one for his bosses.
They don't want to make this story too big.
Newsstands were set up by the Shanghai government back in the late 1990s, when scores of workers lost their jobs under a big economic reform policy. And the government was proud to set up these newly out-of-work folks with newsstands. But officials have since stopped supporting the stands. Now, they've all but disappeared. Local news reports say newsstands have outlived their use. Over the last decade, newspaper circulation in China dropped by more than a third. To survive, some owners turned to selling drinks and snacks. One even transformed his stand into a veggie stall. One local TV station reported that street stalls were becoming an eyesore. And 3 years ago, Shanghai shut most of the stalls, including the newsstand run by Jia Jingwu.
The government decided to close them, so we had to go along with it.
There was a bit of pushback, though, says another newsstand owner, Qu Yali.
Many old people were sad and crying when our booth was demolished. That's why I took over my parents' business and kept selling newspapers. Many of my customers are in their 80s and 90s.
Her current newsstand has no government support, which makes things hard. Really, it's just a table tucked away in an alleyway.
I pick up the newspapers myself, and I can't return unsold ones, like before. I have to shoulder the losses now, so it's a much tougher business model.
Her longtime customers are grateful she's still here. Gao Dongde says he needs to read at least two newspapers a day.
I don't feel well if I don't read newspapers.
But then another customer heard we were an American news outlet. He told Qu Yali, be careful. And the mood changed. Could what they've said be misinterpreted as criticizing the Shanghai government?
Will there be negative consequences if the story is published in the U.S.? Will it cause me problems?
Qu Yali's biggest fear is that by speaking to us, her newsstand could be shut down a second time. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Janet Yellen said the other day in that round of interviews she did about those child tax credit advance payments hitting people's checking accounts. Yellen said she is going to get Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill just as soon as she can. Tubman would be the first Black American, the first woman, and thus break a multi-century run of dead white guys on our money. That history is Ellen Feingold's job. She is the curator of the National Numismatic Collection at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History.
The banknotes that we use today were first designed in the 1920s. And the people who were doing those designs, they didn't think about the role that women played in national history. They had a really fixed idea about a handful of male political figures, people that were seen as founding father figures, and wanted to use money as an opportunity to honor them. And while those figures, people like George Washington, certainly are an important part of our national history, our money does not reflect the way in which women have contributed to the building of our nation. Your money is a really powerful way to send a message. It's something that passes through everybody's hands, both in this country and our money goes all around the world. So who we put on our money says a lot about who we are and how we see our national history. I would love to see our banknotes communicate a richer picture of American life. And that means including a more diverse body of people in terms of age and background. But that also means including, I think, a wider variety of scenes, a wider variety of contexts. You know, I'm a big fan of nature designs, which are popular around the world. And again, I would love to see, depictions of our hopes for the future. And kids are often a part of that. So perhaps children hiking in a national park. You know, I think scenes that help us think about our world moving forward while honoring the people who have helped create and sustain our nation today would make the richest, most powerful scene.
Ellen's interview comes to us from Million Bazillion. That's a podcast we do for kids and their families, answering all those questions kids have about money. New episodes out every Tuesday this summer. Find it, of course, on your platform of choice. This final note on the way out today, in which Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks goes to Chick-fil-A the morning after the Bucks win the NBA title and puts it on Instagram.
Can I put your camera? Do you mind or no?
Sure.
There's 150,000 people watching you right now.
Really?
Yes. So can I have, please, a 50-piece Mac Minis, 50 exactly,
okay.
Not 51, not 49. Chicken minis, yes, 50. And let me have a large drink, no ice, half Sprite, half lemonade.
50. Not 51, not 49, 50. Also, no ice is always the way to go. I just thought that was great. Figured you should hear it. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context and perhaps some advice for the next time you figure you're due for a pay raise. J.P. Morgan gave CEO Jamie Dimon a $50 million bonus yesterday. Stock options, to be clear, that he's got to hold on till 2031. But, you know, for $50 million, I figure he can wait. Here is the advice for the rest of us, though. As part of the award agreement, the board told Dimon, who's worth like $2 billion, the board said, and this is a quote, "The purpose of this award is to motivate your future performance for future services." So try that with your boss. I need an award to motivate my future performance for future services. See what happens. All right, we're actually going. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squilacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, also Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.